Today is the 2nd of February, 1993. This is my daughter Ellen's birthday. I am Francis S. Larkin. I was born in Sherburn, Chenango County, New York, on February the 14th, 1911. My father was Francis Larkin, no middle initial, and my mother was Jessie Blanche Hill, a native of Sherburn, that lovely little village in upstate New York, Chenango County. Now, my father, Francis Larkin, was the oldest son of a family of four children. His father was Francis Frederick Larkin, and his mother's name was Mary Jackson. Grandpa Larkin, or Francis F., or FF as he was quite often called, emigrated from Belfast, Ireland to Canada and apparently landed in Hamilton, New York, where he met Mary Jackson and finally married her. They had four children, Francis, my father, an Aunt Margaret, the second child, another son, Robert Larkin, and a third child, Mary Jean Larkin, or Mary Jane Larkin, I believe was the proper name. Francis Frederick Larkin, or FF, was a most peculiar man. First of all, as a Irishman, he apparently learned the art of silk weaving and apparently was good at it. He also appeared to have been an actor of some sorts. He could recite whole paragraphs of Shakespeare from memory, and also he had a number of epic poems memorized that were the thing of the day, sad affairs. One in particular was called Christmas Day in the Workhouse, and he delivered them with a passion and eloquence that resembled the type of delivery the elocution was using in those days. But nevertheless, he apparently was an actor of sorts. He was a good showman. Then, thirdly, he was a musician. He could read music. He could play bass, tuba, or baritone horn. And he insisted on his children all having a musical education. My father studied both flute and cornet with some teacher in the Utica area. My Aunt Jean, as we finally called Mary Jane, studied trumpet and became a fabulously well-known woman trumpet player throughout the United States and Canada. Uncle Bob became a good trombone player. So you see, he insisted on his children having a good musical education. Now, the things got rather bad up in Toronto and Hamilton, and the family decided to migrate down to the Utica, New York area, and they settled in a town called Clayville, where Grandpa went to work in the factories, the weaving or the cloth factories up there. And I guess my father did too, because as was stated several times, he never got more than a fourth grade education as far as regular schooling was concerned. He had to go to work. Now, Grandpa's brother, one of them, had died, left a widow and three children, Francis, Lenny, and David, and he got them to migrate down to the Utica area also. That is, Grandpa did. So he had quite a flock of four of his own children and three of his nephews around him, so that when the mills went shut down up in that area, Grandpa had an idea that paid off, really did. That's it. Back in those days, there was very little entertainment to the small villages of upstate New York, or for that matter, any of the northeastern states. And Grandpa had the idea of forming a troupe that would go from one village to the next and do a night's performance. What he did was to acquire a large platform wagon on which to carry the scenery and the costumes and the musical instruments. He rented a horse, and they would parade. They would go, let's say, to the next village, and outside the town, they'd stop and put their uniforms on and march into town with his little band of two trumpets, a trombone, a bass, a drummer, and a baritone, with Grandpa marching in front of the children and Aunt Margaret driving the wagon. And then they would put on, they would pass out the handbills and put on a show for the evening. I can't reiterate the entire program, but I am attaching to this cassette a copy or one of the original handbills that they passed out. So you can see they really did a good show, and they were well known and well liked, and they went from town to town. They only had one problem. And that was the problem with my grandfather. He was probably not entirely an alcoholic, but he did love to drink. And he was apt to run off with the profits of the night shows occasionally and leave them kind of in the hole. And that apparently is what he did in Sherburne, New York, so that they were kind of stranded there for a while. And in the meantime, they had lost their band leader for their town band, and they propositioned my father, Francis Larkin, who was then in about 15, to take over the leadership of the band, which he did. In the course of his taking over the band, he met Jesse Blanche Hill, who had a lovely, lovely soprano voice. It was a little more powerful than the average church soloist voice. And eventually, they were married. Now, Dad's whole theory was that all of the little villages ought to have their own town band. So he and Gramp concocted an idea of organizing bands so that Dad would have 5 or 6 bands a week to teach, one in each of these little towns. But they needed instruments. So that's where the big deal came up. Dad, at some time or other, met a man by the name of McClellan out of Buffalo. Mac McClellan was the Northeastern representative for Frank Holton and Company, a new firm started up in Chicago, primarily to build trombones, but we're building brass. With the help of McClellan, the local bank, and Frank Holton Company, he got the Holton Company to let him have a set of instruments, 30 total, on a 90-day note. He took the instruments out to a town and recruited 30 new beginners, got them to rent the instruments for $5 apiece for the 90 days, and then he taught them. At the end of 90 days, he agreed to put on a concert with them. That he did. But the concert also was filled out by Father playing a flute solo, a cornet solo, my mother singing, my grandfather acting, and so on. At the end of the concert, he would call a meeting of the band, and it was put to them this way: if you wish to continue, you will have to consider buying the instruments you've been using. If you do not wish to continue, it's perfectly all right, just turn it in. What it wound up as, he sold them, took the contracts to the local bank, cashed them, and paid Holton. So that is the way. I believe that this is the first outright attempt to use a rental plan to start beginners' bands or musical groups throughout upstate New York. It is possible that the same plan was used elsewhere, but this all took place around the turn of the century, around 1900. That is actually the way Larkin Music got started. We operated from a house in Sherburne called the Old Shepherd House. Dad considered himself quite a writer in those days and was writing musical directions and suggestions for an outfit called the Musical Courier. And he won several prizes for his ideas on the forming of bands, how to teach them, and so forth. Naturally, as they continued, they had to grow. And in growing, they had to change locations to a degree. However, before he left Sherburne, he had cottoned on the idea of, at the end of 6 months, when he gave the concert at the end of three, but at the end of 6 months, he would produce a minstrel show with the members of the band and their families. This way, they raised extra money to buy bass drums, tubas, and so on. Then the idea was carried further that at the end of a year, if everything went well, then they would produce a carnival. They had parades and so forth, and Dad secured the use of a carousel and a fun house, and he had a good friend who was an Indian chief who used to put on war dances and whatnot. And then they would have the carnival, and the money from the carnival went into buying uniforms for the band. So you can see it was quite a grand idea, quite a expansive idea, and it went over very well indeed, to the end that he finally moved the business to Sydney, New York, where he had more room and could rent a place where he could store the costumes for the minstrel show and the scenery for the carnivals and so on. And in the then he hired additional bandmasters. He had one famous old fellow by the name of Colonel Herrick and his son. He had another rather famous march writer called Will Huff, another by the name of Hunter at that time. And he had a series of bands in a good many small towns through upstate New York. Things went well in Sydney until such time as we had, or Dad had, a devastating fire that burnt out the music hall. I have pictures of the music hall, interior and out, exterior, that should go along with this tape so that you can understand more about the operation. The fire was in a building that was supposed to be completely fireproof, so my father bought little or no insurance, and consequently he was in a very, very deep hole at the time of when the fire was over. He lost practically everything, not everything, but he lost a good many items. As luck would have it, many, many of the rental instruments were out to the various town bands, so that they were not lost in the fire. In about the same time, my Uncle Bob came back from World War I. Uncle Bob was a historian himself. He was, without any question of doubt, a soldier of fortune, having at one time belonged to Texas Rangers, another time was a gun guard on a Wells Fargo Express. He also was a member of the police force of Winnipeg, Canada, and he joined the Canadian Expeditionary Forces in the first contingent that went over, and he got very severely wounded, gassed, blown up, and so on. About that time, he came back, and Dad went up to Canada, got Uncle Bob out of the hospital, and brought him home with him. So he had Uncle Bob here. And during the latter part of the war, my Uncle Bob and Dad did a great many campaigns for war bonds in the Binghamton area, to the end that Dad also got a foothold in starting at least two bands, beginner's bands in Binghamton. At that point, Dad decided that the business definitely should move to Binghamton. He secured a location in the Mangan Block, which was at 90 Shenango Street. Back in those days, very few people traveled extensively by automobile. Most everyone used railroads. And the reason we were at Shenango Street was because it was on the same side of the street as the people got off the trains down at the railroad station and would walk downtown. And it was a rather profitable location. We handled primarily band instruments, some sheet music, and so on. We were not heavily involved in the piano business, but we did handle the old Edison diamond disc phonographs. As time went on, the business grew, and we had any number of band teachers working for us. And finally, a Mr. Ricks propositioned Dad about building a regular building for him that would be three stories high, have a repair shop at the top floor, an elevator, a fine piano salon on the second floor, a repair shop in the third floor too. And the building was built, and we moved then into 94 Shenango Street. Again, my father had grandiose ideas. He wanted to expand. He had some excellent franchises, so he decided to open a store in Albany, New York. The point of opening a new store is always in finding the proper employees. He had gone out to the Holton Company, and the Holton people introduced him to a fellow named Carl Joseph. Carl Joseph was a go-getting German fellow, hard-hitting, good salesman, and he hired him to come back with him. He also found in Chicago a small bandsman factory run by a man by the name of Haruska. He bought Haruska's factory and hired Haruska to come back east with him also. Again, right off the bat, he runs into trouble. Haruska cannot speak English, and my father cannot speak the dialect that Haruska used. So he had to go into the first ward of Binghamton and locate someone who understood what the language was that Haruska was using. Things went along rather well, to the point that we, the family, were taking vacations in Canada and Brighton Beach for several years. Dad wrote a new band method called Larkin Step-by-Step Band School, on which both my sister and I participated. At that point, he had hired several other very fine musicians as bandmasters, a fellow by the name of Jake Freeman from the Sousa Band, a fellow named Fraser from the Conway Band, a very fine string man named Brian O'Brien, a German fellow from New York who played with the Metropolitan on flute, George Mulick. So it was going real well. All of a sudden, it was discovered by our bookkeeper, Frank Blowers, that something did not smell very good at the Albany store. So my father went up there with my Uncle Bob and with me, closed the store down, fired everybody out, ran a check, and found that we were short thousands of dollars. This guy, Joseph, who was stealing us blind, along with some of the employees. He put Uncle Bob in charge of collecting as much as he could of the delinquencies, and I was just a freshman in high school at the time, and I was put in charge of running the retail store. During the next 2, 3, 4 years, my father got to the point where he was very, very active in several organizations, Kiwanis and the Masons, and particularly the Shrine. where he became bandmaster of the Shrine Band, head of the Fife and Drum Corps, and was elected to a member of the Royal Order of Jesters, which is a highfalutin fun organization, apparently. But as far as I could find out, most of them were drinking organizations. I shouldn't blame the organizations, because I'm sure that any number of men belong to them without taking on an excessive amount of alcohol, but for some reason or other, I don't know why, my father became quite an alcoholic. We had some rather bad times at that point. He had worked down towards Liberty, New York, Warwick, Goshen, Florida, and organized some bands down in there. And several times, I don't know how many, the state troopers called me and said they'd taken Dad's car away from him. Would I come and pick him up down at Liberty or one of those hotels?
Yes.
There's little doubt that things were pretty bad, and he was pretty down, dejected most of the time. And he was drinking quite heavily. We didn't have anyone at the store except a repairman. Carolyn Engelbert, who had been our bookkeeper for a good many years, she quit. And I was left running the retail store, doing the books and doing most of the repairs, while he was off all week down in the lower part of the state. And he'd come back and had to spend every nickel he'd gotten his hands on. Things got real bad, really bad. We organized a band down in Sayre, Pennsylvania, and it was a fine boys' band, going great guns. And they had the concert, and I got a phone call from Mr. Hevener, who was the manager of the band, to come down and get him because he was shacked up in a hotel down there, in very bad shape, so I did. I went down. As far as I was concerned, that was about the last straw. But I hung on for a while longer until one day, believe it or not, Harry Myers, president of Carl Fisher Musical Instrument Company, visited the store selling merchandise. Dad, again, had to be the big shot and ordered quite a lot of stuff. And I said when it finished, now, wait a minute, we just can't handle all that on a COD. Let's split it in two and send part of it now and part of it in 30, 60 days, depending on what I can handle. And Harry thought it was a good idea. That's Harry Myers of Fisher. And so that's the way that was left. But in the meantime, Harry says, come on, I want to buy you guys a drink. And I didn't want to, but since he wanted to, we went across the street to Steve Hodges, which was on the corner of Shenango and Henry Street at the time. We sat there, and I ordered a scotch and soda with a twist of lemon, and Harry looked at me and said, where the devil did you ever learn to drink like that? And I said, well, I don't know. I just did, and I like it. He said, I tell you what, how about you coming to work for me? Request for me to work for him was great news for me. He offered me right off the bat $50 a week. Back in those days, $50 a week was a fortune, believe me, a real fortune. And so it was arranged that right after Thanksgiving, I'd go to New York and spend a month at the Fisher wholesale place learning stock and catalog. And after the first of the year, I'd start out. And my territory would be the West Coast, known as Denver and West. But I would work my way out down through Virginia to Tennessee, to Arkansas, to Texas, to New Mexico, Arizona, and on up the coast. So that's the way the thing was. I went to work for Carl Fisher. In the meantime, Dad had hired Wally Martin, so he had someone to take care of the store for him. I stayed with Carl Fisher for about 4.5 years. I did quite well. We had 10 salesmen, and I was number 3 on the staff. I learned a great deal about the music business, having calling on little stores, big stores, medium stores, stores that used a rental plan, stores that, almost every kind you can imagine. So as I say it, it was quite a boon for me to I learned the music business better there on the road than I ever thought I could know it. Along about, I can't give you the exact date, about somewhere around 36, 37, somewhere along in there, maybe later, I don't know which, I don't know the exact date now. I was in Denver calling on the Denver stores, and I got a telegram from Mom that Dad was dying, took him home at once, and I sent a telegram to Fisher and got their permission, and they sent me some extra money. I took the train out of Denver. When I arrived here in Binghamton, 2 days later, he was dead, of course. About 30 days after he died, Grandfather Larkin died. So it was kind of a double shot in the arm at that time, a little hard to take. But that's the way the things happened. We got the will annexed to the executors, and my mother and I became executors of the estate. Frankly, at that point, there was very little of anything left. It was a very difficult situation. Through the lawyer, Lou Green, we got a bond to continue the operation of the store, but we could not use money from the store for the operation or anything at all because it had to go into the estate. I missed a point here. Both Dad and Grandfather were buried in Cattellville Cemetery. There is a 8-plot graveyard up there, and Dad and Grandfather are buried there, as you will discover later on, both my mother and Brother Richard are. Anyway, I had to go back on the road for a short spell to get my car, which was in San Francisco, to get my trunk of clothes and to clean up the situation I had left out there. So about August, when the convention was in Chicago, I went to the convention, and at that point I was up very tight yet, extremely tight. And Harry took me to one side and really let me have it. And he said he hated to see me go the way I was going. And he knew that I had a terrifically bad blow, but men had to suffer those blows. And he would like to see me straighten myself out because I was the kind of boy he'd always wanted for one of his sons. And he made me feel good, and I knew I had a very close friend, Eli and Harry. I came back, and things were in worse shape now here than they were before I left. Dick, who had been working for Fisher, had quit his job and come back to the store, and he did absolutely nothing. There was a pile of correspondence, I can't tell you how deep, on my desk. And I asked Wally what it was all about, and he says, it was just correspondence that Dick was supposed to take care of, and he never did. I went down through it, and it was actually orders for merchandise that hadn't been filled. There was checks and payment for merchandise. It was the darndest mess of stuff you've ever seen. Wally said all Dick would do was come to work about 11:30, put his arms on the desk, put his head down, and go to sleep. So that's the way the cookie crumbled there. Well, we had to do something. We had to straighten this mess out, so I arranged to have Carl Schwartz come up from New York, along with his local lawyer, to do an inventory on the business, which had to be done, to come up with a final figure. And then I went down to New York and saw Harry. We owed Fisher at that point somewhere in the neighborhood of $4,000 or $5,000. And I told Harry that if I could arrange a loan some way, why, and I couldn't get one at the banks here, why, I would see that the money that was owed them by Larkin Music was paid finally in full. He looked at me and winked and says, okay, what you're trying to tell me is if I don't come through with a loan for you, you go see Gretchen Brenner and ask them for one. And we both laughed. And we went up to see Walter Fisher, and Walter agreed as how there's no reason why they couldn't. And so he said, well, my wife's got $5,000 or $6,000 she's playing around with on the stock market. He says, let's lend Frank, as I was called down there, $5,000 and get him straightened away. Which they did, and we formed a new corporation, Larkin Music Lincoln Company, Inc. I was not an officer of it. Carl Schwartz was president, and Ruth Cohen, a member of the Fisher firm, was the secretary treasurer. And I, not until I had paid off the loan plus the money we owed them, did the stock revert to me. But when it did, I went to Bob and Dick and said, all right, I'm willing to sell you 20% of the stock of this corporation at the net cost value of $5 a share. And neither one of them wanted to buy the stock. I don't know whether they thought I was supposed to give it to them or what. I don't know. I never have known. But nevertheless, they didn't. And still, I owned all the stock at that time. The business was starting to grow again because things had changed. No longer could you go into a town and form a town band. The schools had discovered that bands were a good thing. The bands and orchestras both were good things for the school system. So they were starting to hire instrumental music directors. And our job then was to start working with the musical directors, to sell them instruments for the school, to rent instruments for their pupils, and so on. And we did a fairly lucrative job on that. But then along came World War II. And with the advent of World War II, the musical instrument business stopped entirely, almost. The government made an issue that nothing of more than 10% of its weight in metal could be manufactured. So that threw out practically all band instruments, almost completely, including drums. So Dick, in the meantime, had joined the Marine Corps, which was always his great love. Bob had gone to the New York State Merchant Marine Academy and was a ensign in the United States Navy by that time. I got a draft notice. And through Mr. Mangan, who was a member of the board, I got a delay. By that time, I also had been married, had a child. And a friend of mine came and visited Betty and me one Sunday, I think. And he had been hired by the National Association of American Red Cross out of Washington as a field director, and he suggested I try the same, which I did. I have skipped over probably an important part of the store operation. After we took over the store, we still could not use the money, so through a deal with Fisher, he consigned quite a bit of merchandise to me. We set up a subsidiary store, which we called 94 and a half Shenango Street, or 94 and a quarter. That was 94 and a quarter Shenango Street. in which all of the transactions of this merchandise from Fisher went through that, and we could use the profits from that merchandise to pay Wally for money that we could use to live on. It was the only thing in the world that saved our bacon. Then in the meantime, as we rented instruments, we would take the money from the rental and buy that instrument for Mark and Music Elizabeth Company, Inc. So things worked out fairly well. So we got our feet back on the floor to a degree. I applied for a job with the National Association of American Red Cross. I was asked to come down for an interview, which I did. I pulled probably the most stupid bonehead play a man ever pulled in his entire life. On the last of the interview, talking to this man who was in charge of recreation, he says to me, "What? You're on a boat with several thousand troops on it, and there's no form of entertainment or anything planned. What do you do?" And I, like a damn fool, said, "Start a chess tournament." Of all the stupid remarks a man ever made in his life, that was it. Why they ever hired me after that, I'll never know. But they did. About 6 to 8 months later, they did hire me, and I did spend about 2.5 years in the hellhole of the earth, British Guiana, British, Dutch, and French Guiana. The business continued under Wally Martin while I was gone, while Dick and Bob and I, all three of us, were gone. And when I came back, things kind of straightened out. Dick went on to the school that C.G. Conn was running for repair men, to teach them how to repair instruments. And then when he got out of there, he came into the shop.